good to be here.
All right. Sorry about the late delay, ladies and gentlemen. I was just on a previous show. Kevin, do you have a webcam by chance? If you could turn that on, that'd be lovely.
If I can figure out how to do it, that would be lovely.
there's a button that looks kind of like a camera,
yes,
which would indicate a webcam. And if you click it, it turns the webcam on, surprisingly enough. All right. So, welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. We're on live 5 days a week, ladies and gentlemen, for your listening pleasure. My very special guest right now is Kevin Galilee. And speaking of the Sea of Galilee, it turns out that there's a bit of a war going on in Fiordland, the South Island of New Zealand, over how much cod people can catch, how much blue cod specifically. And I say, don't make war over cod, just have a cod piece, all right? And now we're going to turn it over to Kevin Galilee. Please tell us a little bit about who you are and what it is you do.
Well, I am a Canadian citizen, first of all. For the past 4 years, I have done exclusively nothing but human rights activism, or political activism, rather, to disastrous effects for my life, but not without success, might I add. Prior to that, I was a fine arts consultant and appraiser and a professional writer.
Mm-hmm. And if you were an appraiser, what was it that you were praising?
No, I was praising old master's paintings and drawings. I was an art dealer dealing in old master's paintings and drawings, and I specialized in Italian art, specifically from the Renaissance period, Mannerist, and early Baroque.
Probably worked for a whole lot of psychopathic, really rich, evil banking scum, didn't you?
Actually, I worked for myself, but I did sell to the large auction houses, Sotheby's and Christie's. But since buyers are remain anonymous, I have no idea who bought the works that I brought to the auction homes.
Ah, I think that's a yes. Okay. Anonymity, don't they? Human rights activism, what makes you go from such a prestigious career path into human rights activism, which will diminish your income, often deprive you of your liberties,
yeah,
and indeed make you lose a lot of your current circle of friends? What motivated you to do that?
Well, I basically fell into it. I was studying Oxford University. I was taking a summer course in 2009, and that just for my professional enrichment. And I was studying political philosophy for about 10 weeks. And that was in preparation for a master's degree in international relations and global order at Leicester University, another British university, that I was supposed to begin, and I indeed began a few months later. So as I was studying at Oxford University, online from the comfort of my own home, it became clear that the academic environment was heavily censored, and that my opinions and my outspoken manner were not welcomed at Oxford. So they created an incident and kicked me out of the course under the pretext that I had breached netiquette. That is to say, I had breached online etiquette, which was completely false. And because it was completely wrong, I appealed that decision. And I went from one adjudication level within the university to another. As this was going on for months and months and months, I began the master's program at Leicester University. And lo and behold, I encountered the exact same methodology of censorship. And in this case, I quit of my own accord because I said to the administration, I have no intention of paying my good money to attend a heavily censored university. It was my understanding that British universities are famous for academic freedom, and that is why I chose the British University, and that was a rude surprise to me, and I would rather spend my hard-earned money elsewhere. So I withdrew from the master's program. And
you dropped out of university for the same reason I did, you know. Mm-hmm. I think they gave me an essay to write about television, and one of the arguments was anti-television discourse. And for the very first time ever, you know, this really interested me. And the reference notes, actually read source material for the first time ever, backed up my arguments, bibliography, the whole nine yards, and they gave me a D minus. And I was like, this is the best essay I've ever written. And they gave me a D minus? Because I'm talking about how bad television is for people, and their argument is that television's really good because it brings people together in a nice, homogenous soup.
Yeah, if you don't pay to the system, they you know, they burn you.
Yeah.
You are supposed to attend a university to enrich your views and knowledge, but instead they just want to create clone basically people the exact same way. People who are willing to toe the line will do as they are told. And that is not my idea of what a university should mean. So, but to go back to the to your initial question, I was going from one adjudication level to the next, and at first I thought it was just the nature of Oxford University. It's a conservative university. You know, my specific tutor was a conservative Italian fella. So I thought it was just an isolated incident. But as I moved on from one adjudication to the next, it became clear that that the course tutor had the full support of the administration, that they were hiding the true reasons of my expulsion, and that they were hiding something else. So by going on and on and on, through these levels of adjudication, I was able to access more and more information. So, but because I was able to compare my experience at Oxford with my experience at Leicester, it became clear that another entity was behind this censorship program. And as I dug deeper and deeper, I discovered that indeed the British government had instituted a program under a white policy paper called CONTEST, which is Britain's a strategy for combating terrorism and countering radicalization. And due to this program, the government had infiltrated two-thirds of Britain's universities and had installed censors in sensitive courses, such as political philosophy, I would imagine also nuclear physics, and so on. And as I was studying political philosophy, I was in one such sensitive course, my opinions were not welcome, so I was kicked out. But once I finished my phony adjudications within the university and I did not get the justice that I thought I deserved, I was able to take my case to the highest adjudication level, to a national organization within the UK, which is called the OIA, the Office of the Independent Adjudicator. And there, of course, I had even more access to information, and I presented a better case. Nevertheless, their decision was a complete whitewash. So, now that I had finished with the highest adjudication level within the UK, I was able to take my case to an international court. So I did that. I went to the I sued the British government at the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg, France. And that is how my human rights work, or my political activism, began.
And let me guess, they didn't give you your tutorage fees back, did they?
Actually, they did refund my money.
All of it?
But of course, they didn't allow me back into the Oxford course. I had only 2 or 3 weeks left to finish it, and they were adamant that they wouldn't let me. But through the Freedom of Information request that I had made, I also discovered that I had been banned from Oxford for the duration of my entire life. From any and all courses and programs offered by Oxford University. In other words, I was persona non grata at Oxford University because of my opinions, I guess, are too
rational,
radical,
logical, actually giving a frackical, you know, these people are freaking nuts. And I don't know about you, but I hate people who are university educated that actually believe that they're educated. They're not educated, they're trained.
It is my experience, Vinny, that the dumbest people on earth are have the highest university degrees, and I have come to this realization, you know, through a lot of pain and experience. If you would have asked me the same question 10 years ago, I would have given you the exact opposite answer, as I held people with education in high regard. But it appears that people nowadays are educated, and they're educated in very particular fields, very narrow, with very narrow focus, And they are what sociologists once called them trained incapacities. That is to say, they know a lot about a very, very narrow field, and they are completely blind to everything else.
There was an article coming out of Natural News by Mike Adams, I believe, talking about how those people who are in specialist fields are in fact usually the least intelligent of people in general. And those who are widely educated in a number of different topics, in fact, the more the better, the smarter you become because you're capable of pulling in information from a number of different data points. Whereas somebody who is perhaps, I don't know, let's say they're a doctor, okay? Doctor knows everything about sickness, illness, so on and so forth, except how to treat it because they don't study nutrition.
I think you've made a good point there. I think universities have realized this, and this is why now they are putting together multidisciplinary academic programs, which is an absolute necessity, because people have lost the ability to see the entire picture. And at the worst time possible, because now for the first time ever we live in a global and extremely complex society, and now we need to have an overall picture, and at this time we lack just that. So to compensate for this abysmal lacuna, universities now are taking steps. So they've realized that education is just does not fit the intellectual and the social environment of our days.
Well, it's much like somebody who's driving a really fast car, or somebody who goes to a really prestigious university on a giant campus. They're compensating for something.
Yes, I guess we all compensate for something or other. But unfortunately, we also live at a time when credentials are an absolute necessity. You know, here in Canada, and I don't know what the situation is like in New Zealand, but I suspect it is the same. You cannot get even a laborer's job without a high school diploma, and that is completely unnecessary. As to people with a BA, a Bachelor of Arts degree, or even an MA, even a Bachelor of Science degree, it does not get you any jobs. You have to continue and get a master's degree, perhaps a PhD, and then
get a job opportunity. and this has resulted in the United States as what's called full nest syndrome. Have you heard of this?
No.
Kid goes to school, you know, pays for their education.
Yes.
They get out, they're educated. I'll do that in inverted commas. They're educated. Then they find out, and this is where their education begins, that nobody gives a frack about their qualification. And they've got to move home, back in with mummy and daddy.
Yes.
Because they can't afford to pay for a house of their own. That's called full nest syndrome. It's happening all over the United States. Education doesn't matter anymore. Yeah. Okay? And this is the irony. You can't get a job without a qualification, yet even if you've got the qualification, you can't get a job.
No.
So it costs you 50 G's to go to a prestigious university, say like Harvard or what have you. Unless you're part of the elite club, right, your education doesn't matter. Because even if you're in, even if you're in said elite club, your education still doesn't matter. What matters is that you're in the club. And that's where you get your employment from. That's how you get into these massive round tables and think tanks and banking institutions and so on and so forth that actually really run society. You're in the club, or you're not.
And because that is the prerequisite for belonging to such clubs, the intellectual level within the ranks of the so-called think tanks, or even the Bretton Woods organizations such as the World Bank and the IMF, is abysmal. And that has been noted by insiders. The directors of these organizations have been lamenting for the past 20 years that the quality of their employees is decreasing.
Yeah, well, that's right. That's what happens when you stop people being educated, which means to learn how to think, and you start training them, which is learning how to follow orders and needing somebody to tell you orders in order to get anything done. We'll be right back.
To fly to New Zealand by plane from New York City, it takes 22 hours. So from the Twin Cities, 19. I mean, I fly all the time, and 6 hours on a plane is like a lot, and 19 is wrong. And they distract you. They feed you, and then they feed you some more, and then they feed you, give me a dessert, give me a dessert, give me a dessert. Have your dessert, you prick, give me that dessert. Have a Bloody Mary, yeah, give me a whiskey sour, yeah, give me whatever you got. Just more liquor, more liquor, more liquor. And then when you're done, there's still 16 hours to go.
Welcome back.
You want to know what it's like?
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, broadcasting live from New Zealand. It is the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. Now, a lot of people have been getting into spirituality later, and what I find very interesting is, despite the fact that people are becoming more spiritual, the propensity for that spiritual belief to encourage depopulation seems to be very almost coinciding. Okay, it's like they go from Deepak Chopra to Depop Chopra in three easy steps. I don't get it, because I'm not insane. And my very special guest is Kevin Galilee. Welcome back.
Well, Vinny, that just so happens to be a subject that has been all-consuming for me for the past 2 years especially. I was telling you and your listener earlier how I evolved from a common citizen who was completely outside the loop and uninvolved in public policy or politics to somebody who is, if nothing else, overly involved. Once I discovered that program of censorship in Britain, and I was fighting for my reinstatement, I exposed a program which I named the covert program of censorship and surveillance, SAC for short, SAC. And I was asking myself questions, you know, why would the United Kingdom would need such a program? Obviously, it was pretty obvious that it was directed at Muslims, especially radical Muslims. But they were kicked out of the country within 6 months of the program being instituted. And afterwards, you know, the machinery was in place, but it was not just was not being shut down. It was growing in magnitude and scope. And this is how people like me, who I'm neither Muslim nor radical nor religious nor you know any threat to anybody. Certainly, there is no bone of terrorism in me whatsoever. I'm a most peaceful citizen. Nevertheless, I fell victim to that.
But under the Patriot Act, you are a terrorist if you use force, and force is defined as words or actions to accomplish a political goal. So yeah. Technically, you are a terrorist.
Anybody who contradicts or threatens the status quo these days is considered a threat to national security and therefore a terrorist. But my work was obviously very, very sensitive, because the moment I took my case to the European Court of Human Rights, and a month later, that was in May of 2011, I went in person to Strasbourg, France, to engage in a hunger strike so as to draw attention to this issue, because the media just refused to publish anything. And I thought that by my public hunger strike, I would basically force the media to confront this issue, but I was also trying to force the Council of Europe to condemn the program and to force the United Kingdom to reimburse all students who had fallen victim to this odious program. Of course, I was completely ignored. Even though I hungered there for 30 days and lost, you know, over 20% of my body weight, and I was addressing the Commissioner of Human Rights at the European Council, a fellow by the name of Thomas Hammarberg. They were paying attention, all right, but there was no indication that I was there publicly, and there was the French media or the Western media refused to publish absolutely a single word. So, but at the same time, while I was hungering there, for 30 days. The media was gung-ho about the hunger strike done by an Indian politician who only hungered for 7 days, and he was his issue was protesting against corruption in India. So that was front page news, whereas mine was completely left out of the news, even though I was right there in their face day and night at the European Council and at the European Court of Human Rights. So I knew something was fishy. Obviously, the program that I had touched upon was of international importance, and it was held taboo by the media. The moment I returned home after 30 days, I was arrested. 2 days after my return home to Canada from France, I was arrested. But what is ridiculous about this scenario is that I was not arrested for my human rights activism. I was arrested for having purportedly harassed my wife. It turns out that the fact that I took on this program and I basically shut it down. Actually, I did shut it down and caused, you know, a lot of havoc with the intelligence community in the UK and the European community. I had made a lot of enemies, not only within the government of the United Kingdom, but also in Canada, because we share the same head of state. And obviously, the order came that, you know, to the Canadian government, you guys better keep this guy quiet and keep him in the country. And in order to keep me quiet and keep me in the country to make sure that I wouldn't cause any more trouble in Europe, they arrested me for purportedly having harassed my wife. Well, lo and behold, while I was in Europe, my wife had been convinced by her family to go along with this. And I guess the initial plan was to just slap me over the finger, scare me into silence, and then, you know, everything would be okay. I'd fall in line, so they thought, and just play according to the rules. But I didn't. So one arrest led to another, and to another, and to another. So for the past 3 years, I have been arrested 6 times. I have had to flee the country for 10 months. When they came to arrest me the fifth time, that was in January of 2012, I was luckily not home. And my friends gave me the news that the police was looking for me. So I headed out east. I drove throughout the night and from Ontario, which is in the middle of the country, to Nova Scotia. Bypassed several roadblocks that appear to have been there specifically to stop me, I would imagine, because every entrance to the highway 401, which is the main highway connecting country from east to west, was had a police cruiser conspicuously placed there. So I didn't want to. I don't know. I cannot confirm that that was there for me, but it was very conspicuous. Nevertheless, to make a long story short, I bypassed all of these roadblocks. I headed east. I drove through the night. I stayed off the highways. 2 days later, I managed to cross into the United States by floating off a half-frozen river between Canada and the U.S. And so escaped the fifth arrest. So for the next 10 months, I spent my time in Florida where I have family. And continued to research and to write, and by that time I had become, famous in certain circles and infamous in others. And some media had taken an interest in me, and I was asked to write on issues of human rights and civil liberties, and I did so. But my research led me to the discovery that the program of surveillance and censorship that I had uncovered in Europe is nothing but an offshoot of the greater population control policy, which I have come to call the global depopulation policy. And this program was obviously needed to keep academics people who would come to graduate and take positions of importance, who could speak, you know, and against the status quo, to keep them in line. So they are basically breeding a new class of.
Yeah, that's right. You know, somebody told me that there's specified schools and educational institutions where the children of those in power, the elite or whatever, get taught an entirely different education to everybody else.
And that's why they need like league schools. Yeah. That's why they have Ivy League schools, and the way they ensure that only their own people study there is by making it unaffordable for the majority to attend a school like a university like Harvard or Princeton or Oxford costs, you know, tens of thousands, if not upwards of $100,000, which is out of reach for the vast majority of the public. So I published through my research. I published a book in 2011 called Water, Salt, Milk, Killing Our Unborn Children, where I reveal for the first time, as far as I know, that the governments of the world under the tutelage or the direction of the United Nations since 1945 have been using covert methods, chemical and biological methods of population control. And the reason they've been doing this is because population control post-World War II was the method of choice and the substitute to war that the international community had agreed to. Being traumatized by two world wars within a period of only four decades, the international community had decided to avoid a third world war by all means, especially since two nations had developed nuclear weapons. So war was no longer an alternative to solving internal problems, whether they are resource scarcity problems or political problems. Since nations could no longer go to war to solve their internal problems, it was decided that the only way to keep the peace and international peace is to control the population. That is to say, if countries do not outgrow their resources, then there will be no incentive there, no pressure to force them outwards so that they would start trouble with their neighbors and take resources from a weaker neighbor, which is what has happened throughout human history. Nations have invaded other nations, tribes have invaded neighboring tribes, and you name it, whatever social unit, however small or large, there has been war.
It sounds very similar to the Avengers film where the bad guy comes in from another dimension and says, I just want peace. Yeah. And Director Fury says, really? It sounds like you want the other thing.
Well, peace comes, it turns out, it comes at a very high price. Of course, in 1945, when the international community decided to avoid war at all costs and embarked on a course of population control as a substitute or an alternative to war, they could not foresee the problems that they would encounter. Because to control population, you have to take on two of the strongest human instincts. One is the instinct to procreate, and then the other is the survival instinct. And how do you do that? How do you convince people to go along with allowing governments to curtail their reproductive rights and limit the size of their families? Well, this issue even today is too hot to touch by politicians, but imagine how hot it was in 1945. In 1945, first of all, there was the historical context and the conditions. The environment was just not conducive to any kind of talk on these issues. The time they needed to act, and they needed to act quickly, and they realized that unless they act quickly, there will be another world war within a decade or two. And the third time, it would be completely disastrous because it would lead to assured mutual annihilation through nuclear weapons. So they began, they acted without people's knowledge or consent. And this is the very, very interesting aspect of this. In order to act without people's knowledge and consent, to attack people's reproductive rights and curtail the size of the family, they had to limit human fertility. And how do you limit human fertility without people's approval, without people's consent? You have to do it covertly. And how
or get them to choose to limit their own fertility by promoting contraception through the American Eugenics Society, which was renamed Planned Parenthood.
Yes. Yes, but you have to go back to 1945. Just stay with me and think about the environment in 1945. In 1945, any kind of talk on sexual matters or reproductive matters was taboo. People could not even tackle the most mundane issues without being accused of being obscene. This was not an issue that was adequate for those conservative times. So, in other words, there were certain obstacles in the way to legislating this or to educating the public to adopt, population control or to curtail their family size willingly, voluntarily. And these, in a subsequent book which I published recently, called "Killing Us Softly: Causes and Consequences of the Global Depopulation Policy," I basically, which is basically a short history of the global depopulation policy, I name all these obstacles that stood in the way, and the most important ones are systemic obstacles, and they're rather obvious once you start thinking about them. Not only was the public at that time unaware of the issue and unwilling to speak to talk about anything related to sex without falling victim to obscenity laws, there was a lack of birth control. The technology of controlling births was just not there. Only about 20% of the population was using condoms, for instance.
We'll come into break now. If you do want to get somebody to do something that they're unwilling to do, you've either got to do it covertly or just brainwash them into thinking they do want it. We'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. No one's gonna take me. Rocking it, ladies and gentlemen, rocking it on the Vinnie Eastwood Show. 5 days a week on American Freedom Radio, you will hear perspectives on the show that you will probably not hear anywhere else. Certainly not in the quantity, certainly not with the great variance that we have on this show. 5 days a week, I give the platform to anybody who my listeners suggest. And because my listeners themselves are very different people, very honourable generally, quite decent and honest people, we wind up getting people who represent their interests on the show at all times. And my very special guest today is Steve Galilee. And I would like to encourage people, if you are capable, my bank accounts are basically dry as a bone. I'm really sick of having to ask for donations, so I'm going to ask for them again. Until I get exactly what it is that I need. I need you, the listener, to support this broadcast only in a minimal capacity. Go to thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Subscribe for $5 a month. Just a $5 a month automatic payment, either directly into the bank account, the Kiwi Bank account that's got the numbers on there, or through PayPal. Having those regular contributions helps to consistently pay the bills and helps us to consistently fund this operation of Guerrilla Media and the Vinnie Eastwood Show to train activists how to do their own media so that they don't need me to do it for them anymore, and also for those who don't have the ability to get the word out on their own, we give them a free platform, free video making and everything so that we can indeed hear from them and get their message out there. Because if the population is not educated as to the reality of what is going on, if the only media that they have to choose from are liars, psychopaths, and the elite, no wonder they will wind up being in control. If you want good people, patriots, those with common decency and morality, to be in control of society, to be in control of themselves and maintain their own personal sovereignty, I need your help to do so. you have a moral obligation to help this kind of broadcast continue. Doesn't matter whether or not you're donating to me. There might be somebody else out there who you think might be more deserving of your support, but just give it to those who are doing the right thing, and you will see society change for the better inexorably. Done with that. Kevin Galloway, welcome back. You were talking about depopulation in the era after 1945, when human beings still had a very, very high level of morality, and talking about sex was something that was very, very much frowned upon. You were considered a deviant if you talked about it in public to a large degree. But now, deviancy is mainstream. It's all over every single conceivable music video you could ever think of. If anybody dressed like Lady Gaga in 1945, they probably would have been burned as a witch.
They would have been arrested under obscene and charged with obscenity laws. That was the environment then. So before I continue speaking about the early stages of the global depopulation policy, I want to thank Barry Hammond, who is your fan. Listener, and he connected us. He made this possible. So, I'm going now to 1945 to talk about the systemic obstacles that stood in the way to legislating population control and limiting family size. I mentioned that there was a lack of birth control and lack of public awareness. But the second important systemic obstacle is Christianity and the doctrine of papal infallibility. And this is going to raise some eyebrows. Now, since 1870, the Vatican has claimed that the Pope is the ultimate moral authority, that he is preserved from the possibility of error. That is to say, he cannot make a mistake. So when the Church, the Pope, commits himself to an idea, to a policy, then that is there to stay. No subsequent Pope can change that. They cannot change that direction, that policy, because the Pope is infallible. If a subsequent Pope were to change that policy, then it would prove that actually the previous Popes were fallible. So the doctrine of papal infallibility stood in the way, and Christianity stood in the way to birth control and abortion, because the Church had committed itself early on, was dead set against birth control and abortion. That is a sin, a mortal sin, and Western nations, Christian nations, could not even contemplate it. Therefore, the political process was not, the political establishment was not going to go against the moral establishment of the Church and institute something like a global depopulation policy. So that was the second systemic obstacle. The third one is the democratic process itself. Why? Well, imagine that you have three candidates for office. You know, Jones, Smith, and Henry. And Jones and Smith are telling people what they want to hear. You know, they're promising them the sun and the moon. But Henry says, you know, if you elect me, I'm going to institute a population control, perhaps one-child policy, just like China did in 1978, or, you know, some form of state interference with your reproductive rights. Do you think that anybody would have then or now vote for Henry, for candidate Henry? No. They would vote for one or the other of the two candidates. Yeah. So the democratic process stood in the way of legislating population control. So you had three very, very important obstacles that were just could not be overcome: lack of birth control and public awareness, Christianity and the doctrine of papal infallibility, and third, the democratic process. But in addition to that, you had a set of historical circumstances, and I'm going to go through them quickly. At the end of the Second World War, the Allied were victorious, and the Axis powers had lost. Well, Japan and Italy and Germany had unconditionally surrendered to the Allied, and the invasion, the occupation began immediately after. Upwards of 200,000 Americans were sent to Japan. and an even higher number were in Europe, helping with the reconstruction efforts and with the demilitarization efforts. So you had this animosity now between the Allies and the Axis powers. And you had a totally different historical environment where the international community had decided to avoid war at all costs. So the best way to start with a population control policy was to implement it on the losers, on the Axis powers. And this is where they began. They began by instituting population control first on Japan, Germany, and Italy, and the co-belligerent countries who were part of the Axis powers. And because they began with these three countries, Japan, Germany, and Italy, the numbers now indicate that this is indeed where the policy began. And how can we look at this? If you look at statistics, if you look at numbers, Japan is the only country in Asia who did not experience a baby boom generation. Why? Because immediately after the war, they were subjected to covert chemical fertility control methods. The same with Germany and Italy.
I thought it was because all the babies went boom in Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
They already had their baby boom.
Hiroshima and Nagasaki were horrendous, but they killed about 200,000 to 250,000 civilians. So statistically, it is insignificant. It would not have changed the demographic landscape of the country. It certainly changed the political and social landscape, but not the demographic landscape. Another indicator, another sign that shows us where the population control policy began is if we look today at which country in the world has the highest percentage of elderly and the lowest percentage of children. And lo and behold, the three highest countries are the Axis powers. Japan, number one, because that's where the policy of controlling population began. So Japan now has 24% of its population is elderly, that is to say 65 or over. That is more than they have 18-year-olds and under, more than they have children. They have more elderly than they have children, 24%. Germany has 22%, and Italy has 21% elderly. Germany and Italy are just about reaching the same statistics as Japan. That is to say, they will have more elderly than they have children. So this is another clear sign that they started interfering with people's ability to procreate in the countries that lost the war because there was a lot of animosity, and it was the perfect opportunity to test their chemical methods on these guinea pigs. So they used the Japanese population, the German population, the Italian population as guinea pigs to see if the methods work.
Can I ask, what methodologies were they using? Were they using chemicals in the water supply? What?
That is exactly what I want to talk about. The first method used...
I'm sorry, we are coming to break. I probably should have left that question until the next segment. How about instead you leave the answers to that question till next segment? And we'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. My very special guest is Kevin Galilee, and we're talking about depopulation and the agenda to control the world through controlling your reproduction. You know what they say, ladies and gentlemen? Nothing is wasted, only reproduced, apart from the human race, as it turns out. We'll be right back after the break at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Don't you go anywhere, folks.